This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You've got this terrible situation of hundreds of children being killed since this conflict started. That's caught in the crossfire, mortars, buildings collapsing. But you've got an even greater number who are now dying because those essential services they need, health, nutrition, water, they don't have access to them.
That was UNICEF spokesman James Elder on the raging war in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, in Libya, there are concerns that no one will be held accountable for the deadly dam collapse. And U.S. President Joe Biden tells world leaders, no nation can meet the challenges of today alone. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. World leaders at the UN General Assembly say women, children, and adolescents continue to face escalating health and well-being challenges due to persistent conflicts, increased living costs, and climate crisis. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The World Health Organization says sub-Saharan Africa alone accounts for more than two-thirds of maternal deaths worldwide. Speaking at a high-level meeting yesterday on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa highlighted the misery that women, children, and adolescents endure.
Almost 800 women still die every day from preventable causes related to pregnancy as well as childbirth. 95% of these deaths are in low and middle income countries. Over 10 million children have lost a parent or caregiver to COVID-19, and 99% of children have lost learning due to school closures over this period of COVID.
Ramaphosa, who also chairs the Global Leaders Network on Women's, Children's and Adolescents' Health, said the global community faces a period of unprecedented demographic change with 1.8 billion adolescents and youths in the world today.
Over 1.5 million adolescents and young adults aged 10 to 25 died in 2021, mostly due to causes that are entirely preventable. These were young people who should have been growing, thriving, and developing the communities that they live in. This session of the UN General Assembly is an opportunity to take stock and think about what we can do.
Under the theme Renewing the Promise for Women, Children and Adolescents, the meeting was co-hosted by the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health, the largest global alliance for women's, children's and adolescents' health. Former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark is the board chair of the partnership.
The world simply can't achieve the Sustainable Development Goals if we leave women, children and adolescents behind. They are the pillars for a better future for all of us. And so we come here today to leverage the power of the highest level political leadership to accelerate efforts around the SDG-related commitments for women's, children's and adolescents' health and well-being.
Some say a thriving adolescent and youth population is critical for global development. Catherine Russell is the executive director of the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF.
And as we need to repeat over and over again, the situation is urgent. We have made progress, but the combined effect of the so-called three C's, conflicts, climate change, and COVID-19, have seriously threatened our hard-won gains. And fragile, under-resourced health systems are at risk of buckling under the strain that they're facing right now.
World leaders at the UN General Assembly in New York adopted a political declaration yesterday that brings hope to developing countries. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States seeks a more secure, more prosperous, more equitable world for all people because we know our future is bound to yours. Let me repeat that again. We know our future is bound to yours. And no nation can meet the challenges of today alone.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden speaking today at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Biden's speech was aimed at convincing world leaders that his vision of American leadership and multilateral approach to foreign policy will help solve the world's most pressing problems. He said global cooperation is key to addressing common problems such as health crisis and climate change.
Nowhere is that more critical than accelerating the climate crisis, than the accelerating climate crisis. We see it everywhere. Record-breaking heat waves in the United States and China. Wildfires ravaging North America and Southern Europe. A fifth year of drought in the Horn of Africa. Tragic, tragic flooding in Libya. My heart goes out to the people of Libya that's killed thousands, thousands of people. Together, these snapshots tell an urgent story of what awaits us if we fail to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and begin to climate-proof the world.
He again denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine as a violation of a core principle of the UN Charter. Leaders from at least 145 countries are slated to attend the annual General Assembly meeting this week in New York, with a few notable exceptions. France, the United Kingdom, China, and Russia will be represented by their senior officials. This means that the United States is the only permanent member of the UN Security Council whose top leader will be present. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has been advocating for greater trade with American business leaders and investors on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. His outreach comes as relations between Pretoria and Washington remain tense over the Russia-Ukraine war, which South Africa has refused to take sides in. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
During his address to business leaders, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa didn't try to avoid the elephant in the room.
We had to deal with one of the geopolitical issues that arose as a result of a war that is taking place far away from South Africa and from Africa. And we got entangled in a whole lot of issues around it, and we're quite happy to talk about that as well, as we took a particular stance.
South Africa's currency, the rand, took a beating after U.S. Ambassador to South Africa Ruben Brigati accused Ramaphosa's government of supplying arms to Russia. But an official South African inquiry found no evidence to substantiate Brigati's allegation that arms were loaded onto a Russian vessel docked at a Simonstown naval base in December. However, the panel's entire report has not been made public. Professor Chris Izike is the director of the African Center for the Study of the United States. He thinks that for now, both countries are putting their differences on the matter aside.
I think that it would make sense for them to agree to disagree. And that means that things will normalize, the ambassador stays, and life continues as usual.
Eckhart Naumann, an economist and associate at the Trade Law Center, says this is no doubt welcomed by South African exporters who made over $14 billion in the U.S. in 2022. He said a quarter of this was for products such as motor vehicles and agriculture, which benefit from the U.S. Africa Growth and Opportunities Act, known as AGOA.
It is ultimately up to the Congress to decide whether South Africa should be part of the future AGOA dispensation, or if it should have a limited part of AGOA, or whether certain sectors should perhaps no longer be part of AGOA. That is all a little bit unclear, but I think the prospects are looking reasonably good that South Africa will also be part of a future AGOA.
As he spoke to American business leaders, Ramaphosa was careful to mention the importance of AGOA, which eliminates import duties for certain African exports to the United States. He said he hoped South Africa would be included for another 10 years when Congress renews the legislation in 2025. Ramaphosa added that he was looking forward to the AGOA forum being hosted in South Africa. The forum takes place in November. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
A UNICEF official who left Sudan last week fears thousands of newborns will die by the end of the year from what he calls the cruel disregard for civilians and the relentless attacks on nutrition and health centers. Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been locked in a civil war since mid-April. UNICEF spokesperson James Elder says every month 55,000 children require treatment for the most lethal form of malnutrition, while in the capital Khartoum, the vast majority of medical facilities are not functioning. He describes to VOA's Carol Van Damme what he saw at camps near Port Sudan.
Well, I saw the virtual collapse of social services. That's how bad things are getting in Sudan. So you've got this terrible situation of hundreds of children being killed since this conflict started. That's caught in the crossfire, mortars, buildings collapsing, but you've got an even greater number who are now dying because those essential services they need, health, nutrition, water, they don't have access to them. So I saw a lot of very desperate people who've come a long way. They could be teachers, they could be lawyers, they could be accountants. They've fled Khartoum, they're hungry, they've scared, they've had perilous journeys. And they're arriving into, very overcrowded camps. It's a really lethal combination for children there.
Where were you when you talk about these camps and how you saw people arriving and their condition? What cities or towns were you in?
I was in very, very, very far in the east, so around Port Sudan. So, and remembering until the last 24 hours where we're seeing some security issues there, that's been the safest place to be. UNICEF still functions in every single state in Sudan. We have incredible partners on the ground, but it's very hard to distribute aid. Security is a real risk. Sudan is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be an aid worker. So it's an active conflict zone, which is a really difficult place both to function and, sadly, to fundraise for, which is making our job of reaching those children ever more difficult.
Some of your people are still in Khartoum, right? And did you get there yourself?
No, I didn't. And no, UNICEF, organization like UNICEF relies heavily on our staff, our brave partners, and we have a lot of partners across Sudan who do everything from nutritional work to vaccination to water, and we have partners in Khartoum. There are no international United Nations workers in Khartoum at the moment. Even the last week, we've seen consistent heavy weapon used in civilian areas. It's very much an active war zone.
Hundreds of thousands of children will be born in Sudan in the next couple of months, according to your report. And given the current situation with few hospitals operating, the lack of medical supplies, lack of medical staff, too, of course, because of the ongoing war in the capital and elsewhere, and there's few hospitals even still operating, mothers don't have enough to eat. What's going to be the outcome for these newborns?
When you look at exactly as you've explained it, which is how UNICEF sees it, and then you bring in enormous funding challenges, remembering funding for UNICEF is vaccine, it is surgical equipment, then you bring in that it's so hard for health workers to be in these places. It's hard to understand why the world is waiting. You cannot put more building blocks on top of each other for a more lethal potential scenario. So the nation is on a precipice. Those hundreds of thousands of women, we may easily see thousands of children, thousands of newborns, and some mothers die in childbirth because the vast majority, you mentioned their healthcare, and we're talking about 90% in places of health facilities not functioning. So UNICEF can't overestimate just how perilous this is right now for those children who are there, for those people who are fleeing, and very much so for those mothers who will give birth and who need skilled delivery care.
That was UNICEF spokesperson James Elder, who just returned from Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Geneva. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. After opening a probe into the Derna disaster, Libya's Prosecutor General Al-Sadiq Al-Sur says the two dams that collapsed from a massive storm had been cracked since 1998. Repairs began by a Turkish company in 2010 were suspended after a few months when the 2011 revolution flared up and the work never resumed. The prosecutor vowed to deal firmly with those responsible. Since 2014, eastern Libya has been under the control of General Khalifa Haftar and his Libyan National Army. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi how credible the investigation could be if the key issue became Haftar's coalition and its historic lack of accountability.
Al-Sadiq al-Sur is an upright man who was selected to his current position in a very rare agreement between the two rival parliaments. I have no doubt that he will work correctly and give the process credibility. But who is to blame? Actually, the area of Derna was only fully under control of Haftar's LNA after February 2019. But nevertheless, he as the factual ruler in the East will certainly share part of the blame, no doubt about it. But it will be also necessary to clarify who was responsible for the maintenance of the dams? Was it the city of Derna? Was it the Ministry of Water Resources? Which one? You know, we had rival governments in Libya until 2021, and we have them again right now. And who of these had access to Derna, keeping in mind the existence of this Derna Mujahideen Shura Council and the separation of the country, even which is even in place right now? Who had the money to finance the maintenance? Did the Sarraj and the Beba governments provide funds for the dams? And if yes, where did it disappear? Which authority could have contracted a foreign company to do the work? So altogether, I would say it is really not easy to find out who bears responsibility. And everyone will certainly have some very good excuses and say it's not me.
But would the disaster result in more cooperation between the two rival governments in Libya?
I think for the time being, there is a huge cooperation between, especially in the lower level, the militias and the forces in the East. But I fear that in the future, also due to the fact that there are many statements blaming one side the other, there will be a deepening of the rift. At the very end, in the East, many people will say we did not receive the funds that we would have required from the West, and our infrastructure is ground down, which is actually not totally wrong. On the other side, people in the West, especially the politicians and the big boys, will say, hey, you had some money and you did absolutely nothing. I would say the truth is in between. But altogether, I'm not very optimistic that this will lead to a real reconciliation of Libya.
That was Wolfgang Porstai talking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Search operations continue over a week since a 6.8 magnitude quake devastated parts of central Morocco. Many worry that the dire living conditions and poor hygiene spell new threats for survivors. The quake killed nearly 3,000 people and injured thousands more. For a first-hand account of what's happening on the ground, VOA's Paul Ndiho via Skype spoke with Emmanuel Victor Ngapela, a freelance journalist. Everything in the village of Im Ntala was razed to the ground.
Right now I'm at Asmi, at 70 kilometers from Marrakech. It's near the epicenter, and here things are going so good, so well. And I was at few minutes in a camp, a military camp, where is a lot of people who came from mountains. And they stayed there, and the military camp take care of the giver food and tent and other things.
Emmanuel, from your assessment, what's going on the ground? How is the rescue operation going?
The rescue operation unfold. The little from all hours of quake continue to rise, and the last. Death toll reach is 2,900, and we have a number of injury claim to 6,000%. Yesterday I was in a peak of mountain in the Atlas. There I found many rescue came from many nations like Spain, France, and other other countries, there is a rescue continue to search people who are under the ground.
From talking to people, what is their immediate need?
To have a shelter, to be in a good shelter, because the climate is going to change in a few days. Because here we are in the mountain, and the climate is so rude. Right now, at 6 p.m., you feel very cold in this moment. But in at few days, like 10 or 15 days, we were very cold here. So people need to be in the shelter or keep there in a warm place.
With what you've seen on the ground, do you think that that part that was hit so hard will ever recover?
The government has taken a lot of measures to rebuild this region. And right now, when I'm talking with you, there is the reconstruction as big because there is the American from here and from other country is more united than the past.
Emmanuel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure.
Emmanuel Victory Ngapela, a freelance journalist, spoke with VOA's Paul Ndiho from the Moroccan village of Imi Ntala. Nigeria's main opposition candidates in February's presidential election today appealed a ruling that upheld President Bola Tinubu's victory. Atiku Abubakar with the People's Democratic Party finished second. Reuters News reports that Labour Party party's Peter Obi, who polled third in the race, also filed his appeal. The two had until tomorrow to challenge the September 6th election tribunal ruling that Tinubu had won. The Supreme Court, the nation's highest court, has 60 days to rule on the appeals. Tinubu, who is attending the United Nations meeting in New York, has defended his victory, saying he won fairly. Election observers said, though, the conduct of the election was an improvement from previous ones. However, delays in uploading and announcing the results might have given room for ballot tampering. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Zainab Abdel Rahman, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.